Okay, so this is the PNI Institute call for Wednesday, October 10th, 2018, and our subject today is PNI for dialogue and bringing people together. So we're going to have a quick running around saying who we are, and then we're going to start chatting. So I'm Cynthia Kurtz. Oh, there I go again. I work in this area of PNI, and that's all I have to say. Okay, next person.
This is Jerry Talley. I'm an organizational development consultant out in California, and I'm probably the newest member of the group. I have only started flirting with PNI.
Mark Anderson. I guess that's all I'll say for right now.
Okay.
Harold, I'm from the Netherlands. I run a company that's basically doing only PNI, and we do projects in a variety of markets, from healthcare, government, documents, whatever. I think we covered almost any industry apart from PNI itself. We never did a PNI project on PNI.
Yeah.
That's still the plan. PNI, but okay.
So we're not guinea pigs for you.
I'm Murray McGregor, and I'm in Ottawa, Canada. I'm a performance storyteller. Firstly, I'm fascinated by PNI, and I also have to thank Cynthia for her deconstruction of the book I in the post. The what is it? I can't remember the title now. I'm terrible with titles.
Animals.
Power. Yeah. Anyways, because I haven't been able to be on the book for the last couple of weeks, and you've done exactly what I was going to do next. In the post that you had from 3 days ago. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, we're
Deadly Power. Deadly Power. That's the title. The book's downstairs on my. Yeah. Anyways, I'm glad you enjoyed it. I found it fascinating. Yeah, it really is. So read Cynthia's post from the 7th of this month, everybody else, and you'll know what we're talking about. I won't waste any more time now.
We'll get into
can repost that part as a summary to the book. So actually, you've written two posts, Cynthia. One is the post itself, and the second part that's encapsulated is the summary of the book. You can publish it separately.
Oh, okay.
It's
Like
early morning.
okay, I can only do one thing at a time.
Okay, sorry. Yeah.
Now, Bruce.
So, yeah, I'm Bruce Walczak, and I have worked with organizational change and worked with narrative and story and sense making for going on 15 years. Not as much with PNI stuff explicitly yet as I would like to. I had proposed a few things with a university a few years ago. They were going to do a project with some graduate students. That fell apart. Still continue to be very interested in this. I also teach at the university level in a business school where I try to bring issues of narrative and sense making into basically all of the classes as well. And I'm delighted to be with you today.
Welcome.
Thank you for being here. Okay, so our topic today is supposed to be dialogue, and I'm sad that I'm actually missing the, I think it's in November, first week in November, there's a conference of the National Coalition for Dialogue of Deliberation, which I went to the last two, but this time it's in Denver, which is expensive, so I'm not doing that this year. But it's kind of like we're doing something a little parallel with what they're doing, and I've really learned a lot about dialogue by participating in that thing and the mailing list and the conferences and everything. So that's a great resource for people who want to get more involved in that. Anyway, so we have usually on these calls, we've been kind of looking at stuff and talking about it instead of just sort of going from nothing. We've been kind of like looking at things. And I, both Harold and I have been writing things on the our blog to sort of start, give us things to talk about. So this time we have the blessing of three different posts about this topic. So I was thinking what we could do is just give like a really quick idea of what's in each post and then talk about it for a while. Does that sound like a good idea?
Sure.
Okay, so which one should we do first?
Well, I think there's an, although they were written in the other order, I think it's very natural to start with your one because it's about dialogue and coming together and approaching, as you say, incremental. And my post is the second one is more about how the P&I process complicates the narrative, and the third one is how journalists could use that to actually complicate the narrative. So it's almost from theory to process to application.
Right. Okay, so let's start with this one that's called Sharing Stories with Strange People, which some people might have read. I think I just posted it on Monday or something. But the very quick idea of this is if you just look at the diagram, and let me just post the link to it, because I think we'll want to look at it together. Now, how do I, oh, the chat.
This is the one with the colorful vertical bars.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. So in the, I posted in the chat this, the link to this diagram. I mean, you can just, you can go to the post too, but yeah, you probably don't want to read all that right now while we're talking, but generally the post is about exploring this diagram. So I was just thinking about, to make this diagram, I was just thinking about dialogue and the discussions I've had with people about sharing stories specifically. And one thing that I've noticed is kind of a point of contention is that I've always said, well, if people are really uncomfortable around each other, they're really fearful around each other, you shouldn't just throw them into a room and say, go ahead, share stories. Stories are wonderful, because it doesn't usually work very well. And it's better to start out getting them to share stories separately and then letting them approach closer and closer and maybe using their stories to mediate with each other. And so that whole post is just exploring that. So what I thought is we can just look at this thing and people talk about it and react to it and stuff. What do you think?
The first thing that struck me is that on the left, that blue, orange, small bar. First of all the bars are small. There's mm-hmm. not much variety. And there's also not much effect of the approach, because these are comfortable people with each other. And so it looks like if you want to get started in P&I, start with people that are not that difficult and start practicing there. It's almost an entry map into P&I.
Well, yes, because I would not take, I mean, if someone had never done this kind of work before, I think it would be really dangerous to start all the way on the right side of that.
Start with a tight-knit community. Yeah.
Although, I think in the middle, it's not that bad either.
Well, you have got a lot of room to play there. If you take the blue one, you're almost always right.
Well, I mean, if you look at the vertical axis, the midpoint, which I guess you can barely see that line there. I should have made it bigger. But there's a midpoint where you're not doing any much good, but there's not a problem either. And that blue line of people just talking like at a party or something, it's usually good, but it can go into the bad if things aren't right. So you can fail there, but it's a lot less likely. I mean, my feeling is that if you, the things that are the most benefit at the top are also kind of the easiest, in the sense that they aren't going to. What's that?
Put your Francis in the middle. Start with a facilitated process, and then move over to, or start with conversational contact or whatever, and then hop on to the next one, so that you change your facilitation method to drive people towards benefit. So, for example, start with the facilitated process because people are anxious and you won't get much benefit. But later on, you go to conversational contact and you facilitate them to the upper blue bar until they have benefit. That's almost the role of the facilitator.
When I looked at this chart, it prompted me to ask a simple question. I'm looking at the far right, and the dramatic difference between just throwing people into a room and saying share stories versus offering some kind of facilitation. And the question that came to my mind is, what's the minimum facilitation needed to avoid the, you know, the catastrophe? What do you have to do at a minimum to keep a group of very, very different kinds of people who are strangers from going off the rails? For example, is it enough to just warn them, you're going to have very, very different stories, listen for the differences rather than similarities, and ask questions when you run across somebody who has had a very different experience? Is that enough? Or would you have to do more?
Well, you know, first I should say that this isn't any kind of facts or anything. This is just my opinions, really, my based on my experiences trying to do all that. I mean, some of these things that are on the bottom part are actually mistakes that I've made. So, you know, it represents.
I think it's a good question because as a facilitator, you always want to facilitate as lightly as possible, or else you would be a dictator.
Right.
So the question is a very good one. What is the minimum thing that you should do to avoid the blue conversational contact where people will end up probably in a fight? Because they fear each other, they hate each other, it's dangerous. And so what is the minimum that you should do to at least land in the green bar, or the orange bar?
Mm-hmm.
Because that is facilitated, that's where value starts, right?
Right, well, I think that the answer to that is that it varies wildly, depending on who happens to be in the room at the time, and what their day's like so far. You know, there's so many little cues that people pick up on, and there's so many self-reinforcing patterns that get started, that I think it's less the amount of facilitation is more the amount of, you know what I'm saying? It's like, I don't think you can say how much a facilitation you need, but you can say that you need to be paying a lot of attention and be ready to respond. Sorry, Mark, I think you were going to say something.
Yeah, I was going to say something about awareness in there instead of quantity. It's awareness of the situation and how things are unfolding and where you need to step in and moderate, I guess, is the one term for it.
Yeah, and in fact, the truth is that blue bar can come up into the positive area. I just think that it's pretty rare, and it's dangerous to rely on that, I think.
This is Bruce, and can I add a comment on this as well?
Mm-hmm.
Of course. All right, so one of the things that I've seen, and I've seen there is research on this too, when you have groups of people in open dialogue, whether it's explicitly asking them to share a story or just to talk about their sense of a certain issue or question before them, whether it's in, you know, again, dialogue, I do mediation and conflict resolution work, it's all the same, or even when you do in with groups brainstorming. We know that what tends to happen is several things. There's anchoring, the first two or three ideas that get put forward tend to focus and limit the range of thought and expression in the room. People begin to talk and think and respond to those first handful of things. there's also the power differentials and dynamics depending on who the group is. If there are bosses or leaders or people who are, you know, just more expressive or have certain ways of telling their stories, those tend to become, again, controlling, dominating, limiting in certain ways. There are techniques that I use, certainly, and that are out there. I use liberating structures, one set of techniques in which we have some explicit methods to try and move away from those kinds of anchoring things. We ask people, for example, in one activity, you write down just your quick response. Doesn't have to be your whole story, but you record in some fashion, usually written, here's an index card or a piece of paper, write down your thoughts and your notes about what you want to say before you say it. That's certainly one kind of thing. And there are others as well to help to work around, again, as I think it was Harold said, you know, you want to facilitate as lightly as possible. And at the same time, you know, to me, you want to try and structure your facilitation of that event and dialogue in such a way as to elicit the greatest natural range of story that's really present.
Yeah, and that writing things down, I think I would consider to be a form of mediated exchange. Wow, I just noticed that I have the colors wrong on that. Huh. Well, that's too bad. I have orange for facilitated process, but actually orange is mediated exchange. My key is wrong. Funny how you cannot notice things. Yeah, and actually I think that the good facilitation kind of usually mixes these things, the creation of these artifacts that become these mediating agents, or in teaching they call it manipulables, like objects that you manipulate to talk to each other and stuff. And then exercises or procedures or shapes of, you know, things that shape the discussion. Those things can kind of work together. So I think that a lot of the things that are in liberating structures and a lot of different methods for bringing people together, they're using these two things, these processes and artifacts, to prevent it being just sort of a melee, you know. And that's why I have that blue bar down, way down at the bottom, is that if you just have a melee with no support, you know, it's just like, here we are, we're going to sit in the room, you're going to do this.
It's a food fight.
Yeah, basically. And in this blog post, and which was partly inspired by reading this book, which Murray suggested to me, and I've been devouring. Well, joke there.
Nice metaphor.
Yeah. The book is called... see, now I'm doing it right.
Dangerous Power.
Dangerous Powers. Okay. Yeah. And it's about how, and this is a really fascinating book, but it's about how up to like 10,000 years ago or so, the predators that ate people were much bigger than they are now. Like if you take here's your regular tiger and here's the saber-tooth tiger. And here's the regular, here's the grizzly, and here's a bear called the cave bear that was, like, three times as big as a grizzly and, like, ate people on purpose. That's really scary. And so this idea is that developed in this book is that actually storytelling developed the need to cope with this being prey and to teach people, you know, this is this kind of predator, avoid them in this way, and also to give alarm calls. And anyway, so later on at the end of this thing, I kind of wrote this because I've been a little frustrated, because I explain to people that you can have a situation where you think, oh, people are sharing stories, it's great, it's working. But in fact, they're sharing defensive stories. They're sharing stories in order to protect themselves against attack or to attack. And, you know, you can get stories, you can collect stories, you can see people sharing stories, and you think, oh, isn't it wonderful they're sharing stories, but it's not what you think it is. It's not productive, it's not working together, it's not working with stories, it's sort of like using stories as shields. So anyway, I mean, I could mention, if I'll just list the things really quickly. That was fleeing, that is running away. And I said this could be physical flight, where people just get up and leave, or they hang back at the back of the room. The cognitive flight, in which is, oh, look at this, I've got an email, I got to deal with this right now, I can't pay attention to these people. Then there's emotional flight, which is that they might even tell stories, but the stories are all kind of, they're not in them, it's just like facts. Then there's freezing, which is to kind of pretend to do it, but not really be doing it. Then there's fighting, which is that you either say nasty things about people's story or try to put people's stories down, or you fight stories with stories by making yourself look good and making other people look bad. Then there's massing, which is trying to form a herd. I've seen this a lot, is that people will, if they feel like one person is kind of challenging them or frightening them, they'll kind of collect, try to bring everybody else together against them. So they'll tell stories and they'll connect their stories in such a way that it's like, well, this is what we're about and you're not that, so you better stay away from us. And then mobbing, which is in birds, mobbing is, you can see it in the sky. You see a hawk or something and all these little birds are chasing after it, and they're all different species, but they chase it away. And so people do that in storytelling too. So like somebody would be telling a story and if people don't like it, they're kind of like, you know, there's kind of like this energy that's like reacting against it. Then there's distracting, which is where you tell a story that totally changes the topic, or you don't like the way what people are talking about. So you tell a funny story that is like trying to push people away from the thing that you're scared of. And then the last one I think I had was appeasing, which is that you are like way over the top about what a wonderful story. Oh, that's so wonderful. So good. And you might have actually hated it and are afraid of it, but you're trying to get them to like you and not attack you anymore by saying how wonderful they are. And then the other one is the self-effacing stories. You're talking, you hear a lot of that. And if you just throw people together, they're gonna, a lot of times they tell these self-effacing stories, which is kind of proof that you're harmless, so you know, don't attack me, because and people tell all kinds of stories about how stupid they are. And they're meant to put off the scent of the predator, basically. So anyway, that you're running through this list of defensive story techniques. I'm trying to prove to people that you can think you're seeing good story sharing, but you're actually seeing sort of pathological story sharing. And
when you see that going on, Cynthia, what do? Do you call it?
Oh, no, that's not a good idea. Well, it's kind of, there's a different strategy for each thing, I think. You'd have to go through each one, really. But sometimes you need to separate people. Mm-hmm. Like if there's a person who's sort of attacking other people with stories or attacking their stories, you're an expert, I need your special attention, boy, right? You say, oh, could you come and talk to me, because I really need to find out this. Or could you, you know, join us this special group of especially useful people, but they're actually troublemakers who are ruining the whole thing, right? So one thing is to separate people who are attacking each other. And you can pretend that it's just part of what you planned anyway. You say, oh, well, now we're going to do this activity where we need some people. Could you do this group? And, you know, you picked out the person who's ruining them. Well, actually, to some extent, the way to deal with these things is to not have the people in the situation where they're going to come to a lot of that in the first place. I mean, that's kind of the point of the diagram. It's like, this, if there's a whole lot of this going on, you shouldn't have held the session in the first place, because that was not the right technique. Right, because these things kind of happen when people are in that kind of melee situation. There's no structure that holds them back from that. They have to fall back on these defense mechanisms, because they're in a place of crisis, of panic. You know, the predator is advancing on them, and they're doing what they can to defend themselves. So if you know enough about them and you've planned the thing well enough, this shouldn't be happening. I feel like I'm talking too much.
Could I ask Cynthia? Mm-hmm. Just one question on that, Cynthia. I was going to ask Stephen here, by the way. I just jumped in. On this idea of the story, is the idea of the story and the story shared in a context with other people like a dynamic, so to speak? So, for instance, say the story is defensive and it's just the story that's now been harvested and is now in the system of sense-making. Is that also problematic, as opposed to like the process of story sharing is being contaminated, or it's becoming the dynamic of how people are eliciting stories and in a dynamic emergent way is affected by people's interpersonal dynamics?
Well, I think so, because on the one hand, if a lot of people are telling stories that are defensive, you can learn something by looking at them and saying, oh, look at all these defensive stories. We can learn something about why are they doing that, or what are the common threads running through these defensive stories. So you can learn that, but that probably wasn't what you meant to do in the first place. So it's something you can learn, but if you had set out to learn something else, then you're not going to learn about that other thing. You know, like say you want to talk about cancer and everybody tells stories about cats, because they don't feel like they were comfortable in the situation you set up. Well, you're going to learn something about their discomfort, but you're not going to learn anything about cancer. So, you know, sometimes you learn things.
Actually, Harold was talking earlier. I was talking to Harold about the system of focus. Yeah. It's like if your system of focus is X, like if the system of focus is conflict, then maybe that's okay. But like you say, if you're not, it could end up just going there every time if you're not careful, because that's what people do in that place or something.
Right. Well, you kind of have to know.
How would you unmute? Mute.
Oh.
We were talking about this earlier. And we were talking about what's the system in focus. What are you talking about? So I think, could it be that fear, are these people fearful for each other? Or do they fear the subject? Or is if you start with a subject that's not very threatening, and then gradually the subject moves to something they fear, but in the meantime, they're more at comfort with each other. So I think it depends on how you start the session, where that fear is actually a problem, or that anxiety. It could be that you start with a much open or smaller subject, and through the storytelling, the subject gets bigger and bigger, and you have to facilitate it towards the subject that's actually meant to be the subject of the whole session, although that's a difficult construct, storytelling and a subject, but it's hard to get people sharing stories about a certain topic and not have them to wander off far from the topic.
Well, sometimes they wander off far from the topic just because of no reason, but sometimes they wander off on purpose. It's this defensiveness that causes them.
Yeah.
They don't want to go there, and so they kind of, you know, walk off on purpose.
But the other question is, facilitator, can you know what you should name as the topic, given the fact that you don't know the stories that are elicited by that topic? So sometimes, like in the football project in Canada, that whole fun thing that came up, that was not people were playing football in the park, while the whole topic of the project was, what's the problem with this football organization? And it turned out that the whole fund thing was a response to the fact that the football organization was a mess and they were far too focused on results. So effectively they created a competing football organization in the park. Do you remember that?
Yeah, yeah. I wasn't catching every word you said.
Yeah, the line is bad. What I was trying to say is, although that stories about football in the park seemed to be off project, in the sense making it turned out that effectively because of the problems in the organization, people just wanted to have fun playing football. And they said, if it's so nasty in the organization, why don't we have football in the park? So they created their own club.
Right. Well, and that's an example of how sometimes you can think that people are leaving the topic, but in fact, you just didn't understand what the topic was.
And for them.
For them, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Sometimes you have to follow them. I was going to say that there are situations and there are methods where the facilitator actually sort of takes on the role of a kind of a protector of people so that they sort of stand between the predator and the prey. And there's one method called dynamic facilitation, which I think, and there are other methods, but that's the one that comes to mind, where the facilitator, and this happens in therapy too, where the facilitator kind of gets really in there and they take a very active role where they, when these defensive things come up, they kind of insert themselves in the middle and say, no, I need you to back off and be respectful or whatever they do. They talk about the rules of the conversation. And now that is a way of doing the facilitated thing. It's kind of in between the facilitated contact and the generic contact. And so I think that's the only problem I have with that is that you really need an experienced facilitator. And the same thing with the therapist. You know, it's like people who are really good at that and good mediators, that's wonderful, but you don't always have that. And so you can't always plan on it.
So a quick question on this, if I may. And what I've been thinking about as I've been listening to this conversation, this particular part of this, is about how we generate that first framing question, which is, tell me a story about, you know, who makes up that question and how that very question gets made is, I think, highly determinative of the stories you're going to get in the first place. And then, as you said, the stories will themselves vary both by intent and by accident and deviate and move in and out from, at varied distances from that framing question and topic. And are there, and this is something else that I'll do sometimes, ways to have the people in the room figure out or generate what is our common purpose or objective or framing question? What's important to us right here and right now, you know, in terms of who should make that decision? And I'm curious what others on this conversation would say about that first piece of it.
Well, what I usually do is be early and already try to get us a subject, a story on the subject from various participants before the session starts, and then ask one of these people, or maybe two, to share the story they shared earlier. Because that's in my opinion, or my experience, a far better way of getting the thing started in a good direction than can you tell me your story about and then some subject. Because you can then say, you already told me that story about blah, 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 blah. Can you tell that to the group? Because I think it relates to this subject. And then this subject is never mentioned. That's the way I try to do it. But
my concern with that is that by doing it that way, you are already sort of setting a stake in the ground and anchoring the focus of the conversation that follows, as opposed to hearing and letting the group self-generate what is important to them. I mean, I've done it both ways. It's not a right or wrong. I think as long as we are aware of the issues that go with doing it either way.
Well, I think it also depends. Do you have a really narrowed down object, like how are we going to manage the lake, which is literally a subject that I have next Wednesday, or we have this problem, what should we talk about to solve it, or what are the stories that relate, because then you don't have an idea on what stories could be like. But if the subject is clear, water management of a lake, then getting stories from the people, and you get somebody very experienced, or somebody, maybe you mentioned two or three stories, I think it's a better way than me asking the question, can you tell me stories about how to manage the lake? So I think it depends on the kind of subject. Is it a problem, or is it a normal subject? That's not a not very threatening subject. It's easier to start than a very threatening subject.
That's true. I think
I mean, one thing you could, I think it's a, sorry, go on.
No, go ahead.
Okay. I was just going to say the idea of, I think this is quite an interesting dilemma. Obviously, time becomes a factor, but we've been looking at the idea of almost like a context analysis at the beginning. Like, what's that? How much can you do like a context analysis before the elicitation happens? So we have this three-day process of like sociodrama topography, and that was actually more around non-disclosure initially from safety perspective with youth. And it became kind of a way to help people not get caught up in conflicts over opinions, adults. So if you can have a period where you're still framing the system under focus, but until we don't actually hear any stories until day three. Up to then, all the stories are not shared. People are just going through the activities and exploring. You write down some on day two and they start to see them written down, but they don't know who's written what. And there's potentially a pro to that, is that you get this chance for them to self-calibrate to the theme personally and collectively. And then that may, because even like Harold, you have this dilemma, like with that piece with the lake, you know, it's like we've all agreed the problem is the lake, but then you've got that problem of like, well, what does everyone think the lake is? You know, we think we agree, but when we find out, okay, so if this lake was to be at its best, it would be like what? And then you could find that people have quite different metaphors. You know, it would be like a peaceful horizon where everyone can sit and chill. And then another one would be like, it would be like a party where the whole community is starting to feel the energy. And it's like, oh, hold on. So you have these slight dilemmas.
This is the Netherlands. We have the swimmers, we have the politicians, we have the fishermen, and we have the nature people. And they all think the lake is theirs. So that's what we're going to do next Wednesday. We're going to make an artificial article in which all these perspectives are shown, and then we will have an international audience, people from Mexico, and it's an international water conference, and they will bring their knowledge from Mexico, from South Africa, from China, what they would do in China to manage this lake from a certain perspective, as a politician, it's almost a toy B&I session, but it's not about the lake, it's about how the lake should be managed.
That's what you're saying. Does it sound true?
Really?
No, I was just saying, I thought that was really interesting what you were saying. That's cool. I was just wondering how that, I was even going to bounce that back to Bruce in a second, as how that goes back to his question, you know.
Well, one thing I'll say real quickly, it's a question that I heard from Meg Wheatley about this many years ago. she said to a room full of people, what if everyone in the room is correct? What if every one of you is right about how you perceive the issue and the problem? And how then does that shift and change the dialogue that follows?
Usually it ends in war, but...
Only in the United States right now, perhaps. I don't know.
No. The European history is full of those type of wars. Yeah. How did they say it? You better be slightly right instead of completely wrong, or what was it? There was a saying like that.
Harold, I was struck by something in your description, because it seems like you're giving the group two different ways of operating. On one end of the spectrum is the story, the concrete database of our lives, the experiences that shape our thinking. But then on the other end of the spectrum is kind of a broad perspective or position. I see the world as a politician. I look at the lake from the perspective of a user. I see it as a piece of a natural resource. And you're inviting them to sort of bounce back and forth between what's the concrete experience you've had that shapes your thinking, and what's your position for looking at the world, which is a pretty high-level summary of my perspective.
Yeah, well, the point here is it's a marketing thing for P&I on an international water conference with 150 water scientists. So we wanted to write a story where there was no scientist, so they can't hop into their own role. So we kind of structured it that way. Say, okay, do you have an experience as a swimmer as a lake in Mexico, or did you ever read a story about a politician making a decision in China? And then after the whole exercise that will be done on a big wall, we will say, now you are the scientists. How do you look at this landscape as a scientist? So we want to postpone their scientific response for say an hour by putting them in the role of a fisherman, a recreant, a politician, or some other role they usually don't play.
So you're inviting them to take a perspective which is perhaps not their chosen one.
No, well, we say divide yourself under the perspectives you like, but not scientists. That one is not there.
Okay.
And then they all, yeah. And it's an experiment because we stage it as an, it's that thing you wrote, Cynthia, on the last method you made on folk tales.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to do it again, but this time as a study.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, as we've been talking, I haven't been ignoring any of this, but I have been brainstorming on a, now I got to remember how to share screen. Let's see, how do you do that? Meeting, start share, is that share screen?
Yeah, click on share.
Yeah, sounds like a sensible thing to do to share.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so you should be able to see this.
There it is.
Okay. So I was thinking about your question, Bruce, and I was thinking that in P&I work, it's projects are usually driven by either stories that need to be heard or stories that need to be told, or both. And so I'm thinking that the way to bring together people might be, and give them a lot of control over that, is to ask them these questions. So can you see what I have put here? And I'll describe it so that the people who are listening to the audio. So on the axis, it goes from the stories that, from the need to hear a story to the need to tell a story. And there's always those two things going on, two threads going on in story sharing. And then on the vertical axis, there's push, which means you are pushing out stories. To pull, which means the stories that you want to come to you, okay? So if it's push and need to hear, it's what stories do they need to hear from you? That is, what is it that they don't know about you that they need to know? So on the pull side of that is, what stories do you need to hear from them? So what do you need to hear from them to understand their experience? And then on the need to tell side, the push is, what stories do you need to tell to them? So it's not, what do they need to hear from you? Because that's focused on them, but it's, what do you need to tell them so that they understand about you? And then the pull side is, what stories do they need to tell to you? So you're actually trying to understand their perspective in answering these questions. And if you had two people trying to answer these questions together, and then you and they answered them separately, you have to start separately. Otherwise, if you put people in a group and said, just talk about this, it wouldn't go very well. People have to have time to reflect on this separately from the glare of the predator, right? So if they reflected on this separately and then started looking at their answers together, I think that might be a way to sort of start out a session.
Mm-hmm. If you do the preparation individually, could you also ask on a scale need to avoid versus need to hide? You don't want to hear stories about, and you don't want to hear about?
Yes, you could do the same thing. I'm not sure if I can put it on the same diagram, though.
No, I'm not sure about the y-axis, because there's no push and pull. But there could be a reaction. What will you do if stories are told about, like, flee or the things you talk in the book, the book summary? If all the things in the book were on the y-axis, and suppose somebody told a story about, what would you do? Grab my phone, leave the group, wander off in another subject, tell a guarding story, that kind of thing.
But you could also put it as the questions. In fact, you could almost put it on the same thing, where you could just say, what stories do you want them not to hear from you, right?
Yeah.
And then.
So somebody asked you, can you share that story you told me in confidence last week? And now you're asking,
no. What stories do you need not to hear from them? You know, you can imagine somebody saying, I don't want to hear about your hardship, you know? I can imagine people actually saying that. So this is kind of like almost sort of a way of mapping out kind of hopes and fears. Let's see, what stories do you need to not...
Yeah, doesn't work there.
No, it works there. To be able to hide from them, right?
Okay.
Yeah. What stories do you need to be able to not tell them? And then, let's see, this one would be, what stories do they need to not hear from you? Yeah, because this negative one, you're basically mapping out fears about the other people. I mean, because like, if we try it, let's say, if you think of someone that, like a terrorist, let's say, you know, what stories do I need to be able to hide from them? Well, I need to be able to hide my private life, right? I mean, you don't want to expose yourself to people who you think could target you, right? What stories do they need to not hear from me? Now, see, now I have to put myself in their frame of mind. I have to do theory of mind, right? So
you're a nurse in an understaffed hospital, and you're talking about working pressure, and you don't want to tell what you do on the weekend because it's your weekend.
Okay, that's an easy...
And you don't want a later reaction. Yeah, but you're partying on the weekend.
Right.
You take care of these kids in need. I mean... That kind of a story. I don't want to talk about my weekend.
This could actually form an interesting exercise where you basically start out two groups in separate rooms or separate times and you say, okay, tell some stories that match all of these categories. And for the ones that are for the other people, you're kind of just imagining, right? You're guessing what they might think. Like, so if you look at what stories do they need to not hear from you, you're kind of guessing at what their reaction would be to your stories, stories that they don't want to hear from. You know, I don't know. But then if you actually show people these lists of stories, then it would tell them a lot about each other. And then they might be able to go on to then tell some of the stories that they actually want to hear from you. In fact, it's also possible that they might want to hear some of the stories in the negative parts, right? If I say, well, I don't think you want to hear the story from me. And they might say, well, actually, I do want to hear that story because, you know, you piqued my curiosity now and I want to learn about that. So that would be actually kind of a cool thing to do.
Oh, Bruce has left.
Oh, okay. I'm going to stop sharing.
I lost connection for a moment. I am back.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Well, I was thinking in how far are we talking about the subject of gradually moving into a session or not. I mean, let's start sharing stories at 9 o'clock. I mean, it sounds so artificial. So in how far can you set up a session in a way that it gradually comes together, story sharing starts, and it's almost a natural thing that happens instead of let's start at 9 o'clock. I mean, inviting people early for coffee and things like that helps because you can welcome people. But I was wondering, related to the question Bruce has, in how far does a gradually moving into storytelling solve the problem or bring benefits to the goal or whatever?
Well, I don't know. I don't have a lot of faith in gradual because it can be really hard to helm the ship of story sharing, right? It's not that easy to direct it. Especially once it gets going, it's not that easy to intervene because people really don't like being told what to talk about. I don't know. I think it's better.
That was my question before about who decides what the question is and what happens when the question evolves. And now the question is not the question you started with. You've moved elsewhere. And is that okay? You know, maybe it is.
Well, I think to some extent that is okay. I think the safest thing to do is to start with something that you know from, because you know the groups of people, is going to be common. So like, for instance, if you have two groups of people that you know are going to disagree, you can talk to them about something that is common to everyone, like talk about pride in your work or, something that you think that everyone will be able to talk about. And then it's kind of this safe space. It's almost like when there's, approaching armies, right? And the armies are ready to go to battle and they send people out into the middle into this special space. And, the space is surrounded with white flags or whatever. And it's a special space of the things we do here are different from the things we do everywhere else. And we've ensured this commonality here. So it's like you can create a safer space to talk about a limited range of things that is less prone to conflict and then see if people can kind of be in that space for a while and then start to move out from that space to the place where they might start running into the problems. I'm not sure if you can get a really big distance there, but what I mean is that has a limited functionality, but at least it's a place to start. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah, I was thinking too, as we've been talking about the underlying issues, we've been talking about the differences in the way people will think about the question and think about the stories that they'll tell, and how the stories always reflect the underlying sense of norms and values and ideologies that people hold, however in their lives and their lived experience they get to that place. something that I first heard and thought about many years ago from Ralph Stacey. But I learned a couple of years ago a really pretty fun, easy, and cool technique that comes from improv and facilitation to help identify the underlying core values that are present in a room full of people. That I learned from my friend Michelle James, and she admits she got it from somebody else with improv. And it's a way, you know, people don't even realize that what you've got them doing is identifying the whole room's set of core values, what's most important to the people in the room. And then once they see that, using that then as a lens through which to think about and frame the stories that they're about to tell. That's just another technique that sometimes I find helpful.
Can you describe that technique or something?
Sure. So you ask people to form dyads, and you tell them that what they are to do, and again, this is an improv technique, they speak one sentence at a time in turns to create the world's greatest birthday party. This was the way it was taught to me. Mm-hmm. And so the world's greatest birthday party would have this, 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 and then the other person gives a sentence. And the dyads do this for about 5 minutes or so, and then you ask each dyad to put up, and then you record to the board or the flip charts all these great ideas that people had, and then no limits. You encourage them. There's no such thing as impossible. You know, we're going to fly to the moon together for this birthday party. Great. And then you ask people in the room for each one of these listed ideas of the world's greatest party, name three things that make this great. No critical, only positive. And what happens then, that's the key point. When people identify what makes a certain idea a great idea or a useful idea, they're expressing their underlying values. And those things that you then put over on the other column, these are the things that make it great, clearly reflect the underlying values that are there and present in the room, how people think about stuff in the world and in their lives. And then use that list of the underlying values and say, all right, here's what seems to be important to all of you. You know, it's going to make me happy. It's going to make me healthy. It's going to make me rich. I can water ski on the lake, or I can catch fish in the lake, whatever the deal is. Mm-hmm. And use that then as the lens to say, all right, we know what's important. Now take a minute, think about your story, and now let's go on with the story.
Yes, and that the birthday thing is well chosen because that's something that every human being has, is birthdays, right? And it also connects to children because, you know, nobody doesn't love their children unless, you know, well, anyway, normally. There are some universal human experiences. You're laughing at me. Well, there are people who don't love their children, but it's not. You
know. Yeah. There's a lot of projects about them.
Anyway, but that's an interesting way of getting people to that spot. It just saying.
Sorry to say your audio is breaking up on my end, but I'll get it later.
Oh, okay. It's kind of like maybe the first step is this, let's all recognize that we're all human beings here. And that's kind of like a baseline. And then you can start moving into this exploration of this, what do you need them to hear from you? What do you need to hear from them? That's actually taking a step into a little bit of danger. But if it's managed, then, I mean, that diagram that I just made was another facilitated process. So yeah. Again, you're moving into facilitative process. So it seems like pretty much, and even, I mean, this thing that Bruce just told us about, that's a facilitative process. So it seems like every time we find a way to help people talk to each other who are very different or who are afraid of each other for whatever reason, we move into facilitated process. And that's why I think that you just kind of have to, that's just whatever the process is, and there's a lot of different processes, there has to be one. Mark is talking. Mark, we didn't hear you.
Bruce was mentioning of improv kind of reminds me of another improv technique that I've heard recently, that people that are in improv have to practice for improv. And I was shown a thing where they go around the room and they all say a car that they want. They all have their own car that they want to say, and they listen to them in order. And it's when they hear the car before them, then they say their car. And then they do it with another thing, maybe with fruit, and everybody names a fruit. And then they try and get both those things going at the same time in the group to help them to really listen. And kind of a way just to get them to really listen to each other deliberately, and practice it over and over, and then go into the stories, and then they'll probably listen better to the other stories without thinking what they're going to say about them, maybe.
And these techniques, on what kind of, on what side of Cynthia's original diagram do you need those? I mean, if you have a very group that you know very well, my experience is that they wander off in the chat like a cafe instead of sharing stories about the project is almost inevitable. So I would almost say that, like you say, Cynthia, the mediated exchange gets the most benefit because it disrupts their, we know each other very well, we are like each other, cafe-like routine that doesn't produce the results you need. While on the other side, on the fear side, you need to mediate, you need to start with something else before they can arrive in the situation that they productively start sharing stories about the real subject of the meeting.
Right. And in fact, on the right side, which I tried to draw here, is that my experience has been it always works better to separate the groups completely, have them do a bunch of story sharing within each group. So say it's teachers and students or doctors and patients or, you know, any two groups that are not, don't work well together, just if you throw them together. If they go through some story sharing within the group and then they kind of do some thinking about, they bring those things together into a mixed session. It's like the artifacts that people create in the separate sessions can be used to support the facilitated process when they come together. And so, because like for like one example is that there was a project I helped somebody with where they had two groups of people and they each developed a landscape of stories. And they were separate for the whole thing. And then finally at the end, they said, okay, now we're going to show each other our landscapes. And looking at the landscape, these artifacts that they had constructed, it gave them this way to talk about things and a way to say, oh, why'd you put that there? And what's this mean over here? And it gave them something to kind of work with as opposed to more of just judgment of each other. It was like gave them an artifact to negotiate over. But the artifact arose through sharing their experiences. And then after that negotiation over those artifacts, then they could start actually doing a facilitated process to share stories with each other directly. Go ahead.
So if it is a group of nurses and if it is a group of doctors and they don't know each other, then that initial story sharing, Stefan, that was what we were talking about, creates a sense of us in the two groups that as soon as the groups mix, they're not alone anymore. They're not fearful individuals. They only fear the doctors. Right. But they know that their sisters, nurses or their fellow group members are in the same circle. So I think that's part of the things that these things create is a sort of unseeable trust. The doctors don't see the trust. The nurses don't see the trust among the doctors, although the doctors are trained to trust each other. that the nurses are from different hospitals.
And also, if you take the meaning...
Sorry?
I was just saying, like you're saying there, with the trust and the meaning making, there's a sense that they've had a chance to orientate beforehand. So in the same way as with this improv activity, which could be one way to inform stories, that could maybe come before another piece, which maybe is like the twice told stories. Like you take these stories, which maybe... As, well, let's take an extreme. If you take the improv activity and someone's talking about if I could, you know, this lake could be done the way I'd like it and it'd have aliens coming in doing whatever in an improv activity, which is clearly like supernatural. But the values there in, and the stories around that, it might not matter if they're not totally focused in the exact form. If you then have a more twice told story section where the push-pull need to hear, need to tell piece is more explicit. And it may be that by not having that, so one of the things I always think about is how much can the process take before it falls over? And there's certain advantages to the exploration piece to not have too much demand from the explicit knowledge piece. Because you know, if I'm trying to work, oh, what could I do here? I could go here and wait a sec. I'm trying to think about if they need to hear it or need to tell it. You know what I mean? If that lens hasn't got to be placed on me, I can, especially with improv, for instance, it's kind of hard in improv. I mean, forum theatre kind of gives a lot of framing to help you be more explicit. But improv, it's like, it does raise a question. So I think this is quite an interesting point. But how do you move them to this piece here? So for instance, if someone's exploring water as a lived experience, it may be that that needs to go straight into this push-pull need to hear, need to tell, or maybe you choose to have a more contextual analysis piece early on, which is maybe more about what's it like to live around the lake? I don't know.
Oh, well, what the thing is, I would never take that diagram that I just made with the push-pull and need to hear and need to help to an individual. Because let's say you have a room full of people and you just threw this at everybody and said, and the people are very different, and you said, okay, fill this in. You wouldn't get a good result. You'd need to take the people and put them into groups of sort of like people first. Have them just share stories about the topic freely, right? So they've shared a bunch of stories and then say, okay, now that you've kind of got this feeling of who you are and what ties you together and what your experiences have been, now let's look at this diagram and think about this other group. It's almost like you have to think about us first and then them after, right? And then well, I think that would be a stage toward then talking to them about it.
But if you're taking Bruce's question, what is the elicitation question you should ask to get story sharing going, your diagram could be very useful to go to give to participants before a meeting and say, please email me your story or things you don't want to talk about.
I don't think
and then
on their own though.
No?
That's what I think. I think that and there's two different ways to do it. One is to say, what is the question that would bring people at first contact into that? And what I'm saying is my experience has been that you can't just do that. You can't just bring people into first contact with people they fear with one question. You need to have this phase.
So there is fear in the system, but there is not fear in the initial group.
Right.
If you have the system in a room, there's fear. If and but by separating people like to like, which is only necessary on the right side when there is fear, because if people know each other but don't fear each other, don't know each other but don't fear each other, there's no reason to do this, because there won't be that problem. There's no need to approach.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, this is we're all only talking about on the far right here, the far right of this diagram.
The right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
In a way, actually, we're kind of talking about going back and forth between process and artifact. You know, we're kind of like cycling between process and artifact. And then at some point, it starts process and artifact cycling within each separate group. And then at some point you say, okay, now we're ready to do this cycling in a combined cycling. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, anyway, I feel like we're taking up too much of the time on this. So Harold, do you want to quickly give us a quick idea of what it says in your contradicting, complicating the narrative. Just read off your titles or something so that we can have a quick discussion of that.
You mean the diagram?
This is your part. So what do you want to do? Do you want to talk about the diagram in your dialogue and conflict in the PNI stages, or do you want to go into the thing?
I think dialogue and conflict in the PNI stages, because we're talking about PNI.
Okay. You need to explain that for, I'm not sure Bruce can look at it because he's in the car. So can you just kind of describe that diagram?
How do I share a link? How do I share?
Yeah, I'm actually on the move driving in central New Jersey right now to a unique event, but that's another story. Right. I'm here. I'm paying attention, sort of.
Can you share it, Cynthia? Because I don't know how to do it.
I put the link in the chat, but can you just describe what the diagram says anyway?
Yeah. What I did is I've written a post on conflict and dialogue in the various PNI stages. And I also created in the end of the blog. So I go through the planning stage, the collection stage, the catalysis stage, the sense-making stage, and then mapped these stages on also a landscape. Although it's not a landscape, it's more a canvas with four corners, where the corners are story sharers, so the people that share stories, the facilitator, the customer, which is the one that pays for the project, and the context, which is anything outside the sense-making or story-sharing group. And what you then see that in the customer, what we experience or I experience in the planning phase of a project, is that the customer usually wants everything. They want to hear every story in the organization, while the facilitator is trying to get a reasonable project. And so getting the scope right, getting the story sharing right is usually... Well, sometimes it can be a chilling factor in the project, but what we found, if you do a small story circle or something different, something similar early on, the customer starts to understand what stories are, and that helps a lot. We do a lot of projects where, because it's very hard these days to get people together, so on the story collection side, we almost always... soon in the project work with a story point, and we mail people or we post on Facebook or try to get people share stories. And we've done several projects where 1,000 or 2,000 emails are sent out, or 100,000 of tweets or things like that. So there the conflict is on the story share. What kind of story do you want to share, and how do you answer the questions about the story to give the metadata to the story, and who do you want the story to share with? All this internal conflict, all this conflict and dialogue with the person himself is in the story share. So that's why that dot is on the upper and the lower left corner. And then when we follow the line to catalysis, then suddenly all the conflict is in the facilitator, because he has to decide on the scoping and what's a good story or not, which core stories to discard, whether to evaluate to value a pattern, yes or no, how to phrase an observation. All these things are with the facilitator. And we are very glad that we now finally, after 8 years, landed a project where a group from the customer will join in on the catalysis. So we will do it together. Cynthia will be part of that project too. But that doesn't place all this conflict on the facilitator.
So that bubble's going to move for that project to conclude some people from the customer or the...
In this case, the Department of Education.
Right.
So it will be the civil servants. Mm-hmm. It won't be teachers or students, although there is a teacher in the group. The Department of Education in the Netherlands has the habit of hiring 200 teachers a year, and they fire them after 2 years. They can either become a civil servant or go back to class. So there are a lot of teachers working in the Department of Education. That helps us a lot in this project. And then after catalysis, when you move to sense making, I made a very small dot in the middle because I think there the story sharers, the facilitator, the needs of the customer and the context all come together. So this dot could fill the whole space, but I made it a small space in the middle to indicate that it's a balancing act. And then usually when you go to interventions, it moves up between context and customer. Because there the question is, what can we do as a group? What interventions, what changes, what measures can we propose or take or investigate given the context or the subject that we have here? And then, of course, after intervention, it goes into practice, and usually it ends up in the normal world. So there's a big dot there in the upper left corner, after which the project goes back to planning. And now I notice that I didn't put evaluation in there because it's not in the diagram.
But I think it's part of return, though.
Yeah, it's part of return. But what I mean with return, maybe there should be two dots. One, what interventions are actually carried out in practice of the organization. Mm-hmm. And the other part is more, how does narrative work feel for you? And how does working with colleagues land with it? So that's more the evaluation of the P&I process itself.
I think you could have multiple dots for each of the phases and like different aspects of them. Like there's an aspect of return.
Yeah.
That has to do with the subject matter. There's an aspect that has to do with the people sharing stories. There has an aspect that has to do with, actually, the return is kind of like sense making. Everyone's involved in it.
Yeah. Although usually the customer wants something changed or they want the result, and they always ask, what are we going to do with all these insights from all these stories? They're almost impatient to see what happens as a result of the project. So that's why I put return in the upper left corner. But you're right. What did the project do to the customer? What did the P&I facilitator learn? What was the benefit to the storyteller? The number of thank yous in the story form. I really like the ability to share my story in this project. It's huge. Usually. So, yeah. That's my summary of this attempt to map the conflict in the P&I process itself.
So my reaction to this is, for each of these sort of thoughts, what is good about the conflict, like what's productive about it, right? And what is bad about it in the sense that it's what's the opposite of productive? Unproductive or something.
Counterproductive.
Conflict. Yeah, productive and destructive. That's it. Because there must be elements of the conflict in each of these situations that are productive. Like, you need that sort of churn to progress.
Yeah.
There are destructive elements where it can just cause it to fall apart. That would be interesting to explore, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and the other thing is, I mainly mapped conflict. I didn't map dialogue. I mean, maybe that's also a part of the... Of your answer, where is constructive dialogue going on? Because, if, for instance, in the catalysis study, it always seems like cramped for time, not enough time, can't get deep enough, I can't explore enough. On the other side, you follow your nose. So it's that's why I think involving more people in catalysis will be very beneficial, although it will be a difficult thing to do. Because you get all these perspectives on board, and it's much easier
to do observations, because everybody will have an observation. And as an individual, you must force yourself to have multiple observations. As a group...
Sorry?
Interpretations.
Interpretations, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing, of course, is that somebody finds it weird that a certain bar is low, while the other is intrigued by the fact that some other bar is high. So, yeah. What is a useful observation might be a description too. I don't know.
Well, that's why you try to set kind of standards for that. You say, well, but it is hard to do that. I think that you could actually list for each phase. Three things you could say. Where's the productive conflict in this? I do mean productive conflict. That is disagreements that help people. And then where's the destructive conflict in the sense that in this would be like almost per project or maybe in examples. So destructive conflicts would be like we can't come to an agreement on this and we just start attacking each other and it falls apart. Where is the dialogue? That's a separate thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I was looking at your five principles of catalysis and I was just realizing losing mischief could be a non-productive conflict.
No, if
you lose it.
Mischief.
If you don't achieve enough, then it's getting counterproductive or it's getting harmful. And I think that's partly solved by getting multiple people in the synthetic or in the catalysis.
Well, those sort of principles of catalysis came out of non-productive destructive conflict, which was that first project where I did a report and they just started attacking me and saying, "You don't know what you're talking about. You're an idiot. You're useless," and sending all me these nasty emails where I just didn't even want to continue doing this work for a while. And so I said, if I'm going to keep doing this, I'm going to have to find a way to do it where disagreements are useful instead of just destructive. And that's where that was born. If I'd never had that experience, if every single project there'd been a report and everybody would have said, "Oh, obviously that's perfect," then this whole technique would have never developed. But it was inevitable that it would have happened because you're listening to stories. And everyone has a different perspective on what every story means. So you can't just say, that's the whole thing of where I say it's not science and we can't say we're proving anything, is because every story can be interpreted in many ways.
Yeah. Looking at the time, it's 3 minutes before the end of our talk.
Yeah.
Can I make another remark? That I have the feeling that the last sessions we've been actually developing P&I.
Oh, sure. Well, that's what
almost every
room we created.
And the bad news is, everything we put on the blog needs further development after the talk. So you simply should we discuss your diagram and it can be expanded, and you created one halfway. And now you say, okay, maybe my diagram, you can make three versions. So we're even getting homework from these sessions. Yeah. That's bad news.
We can come back again. Well, I mean, this is all part of keeping the whole thing alive. I mean, if P&I becomes something that is just a set of things and you do it and you never change anything and you're not allowed to change anything, then everybody's going to get bored. I mean, it has to change or it'll die. Right.
Yeah. Well, we are working with a party that claims that P&I can be replaced by artificial intelligence. So we said, okay, we're gonna work with you and see how far we get. Because if some parts can be replaced by artificial intelligence, it would be great. I don't believe them. But
so I don't feel like enough from other people besides Harold and me, so we've been dominating too much again. Sorry.
Yeah.
Somebody else say something.
Well, this is Bruce, and you may or may not have noticed from some of the video that I am not in the place where I was. I am in a very unique setting right now that lends itself to story and dialogue, and you can look it up online. It's called Grounds for Sculpture. It is perhaps the most unique place in the state of New Jersey and one of the most unique places I know. But getting back to the conversation, what strikes me again in all of this are these notions of how we may begin together, we may converge and we may diverge, move apart and separate groups to think about and express stories. And then, like you were saying before about, you know, sort of drawing the map. And when we come back together, comparing and seeing what's same and what's different. But what struck me through all of this is issues of how people think about and act into uncertainty and ambiguity and complexity. And I would be curious to hear from others how, if at all, you try to work with the people that you have in that room about their capacities to respond to and adapt to those issues of complexity, uncertainty, and ambiguity. And I'll pause there.
Well, I would say that's exactly what we're talking about. I mean, the whole basis of fear of other people is uncertainty and ambiguity and complexity. It's that we can't pin them down, right? We don't know what they're going to do next. If we did know exactly what we're going to do next, then there wouldn't be that much to fear. Actually, it reminds me of this project I did a long time ago where I collected all these stories about asymmetrical conflict. I think that was it, yeah. And I had this one landscape where it was, I was comparing all these different axes, but one of them was a comparison between morality and predictability. And what was really interesting was that, and this was all gathered from reports of conflicts and things, and you know, international conflicts. And one thing that was really surprising to me was that when we judge someone as completely immoral, like horrible, horrible person, horrible dictator or whatever, they were extremely predictable because you always knew what they were going to do. They were just going to do the worst thing that anyone could do, right? And people who were extremely good were predictable. The people where you had the most uncertainty were they were kind of in between, right? It was hard to guess whether they were going to do something that was better or worse for you. And that those were the people that kind of created the most difficulty of figuring out what to do with them. Anyway, I don't know.
Was that the Monterey project?
What's that?
Monterey project?
Maybe.
Yeah, with all these landscapes.
Yeah,
but I think you're right. Sometimes in story work, you find these simple patterns that are very predictable, and the whole thing is that muddy, disordered stuff in the middle, where whatever you color the dots by, they're all over the place.
Yeah, but here's the problem, is that in order to bring two groups of people together, a lot of times the further people are apart, the more they think the other group is predictable. Right? They think, I know exactly what they're doing because they're despicable. You actually have to drag them into the space of uncertainty where they question all their assumptions about these other people. You have to actually complicate things for them. It's like that whole thing of complicating the narrative. You have to bring them into a state of higher uncertainty before you can pull them out the other side to where they have found more common ground and understand people better. So in a way, you almost have to make things worse to make them better.
But I think that's true. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, one of the things that I was thinking about listening to this, about bringing people into these greater states, I don't know if any of you have ever played the role-playing game Dungeons & Dragons, and explicitly in that game, characters have good or bad intentions and are, you know, kind of tending towards order or disorder. And you can be a so-called chaotic character, but you can be chaotic, good, evil, or neutral.
Yep.
And it's those chaotic neutrals that, just as Cynthia was describing, you don't know what they're going to do. And in the game, it's literally the roll of the dice that help to determine it. But I think very much the same way in you know, with we humans, you know, bringing people into that greater state of tension and ambiguity is a way of compelling some catalyzing, hopefully, of meaning to enable a coordinated and adaptive response and a better outcome.
Right. Well, I played that game a lot when I was a teenager, and every single one of my characters was neutral.
Ah, there you go.
So completely unpredictable, but I knew people who could not play unless all of their characters were lawful good.
Lawful
evil. I mean, they had to be simple. And they just wouldn't play the game in any other way. And so there are a lot of people like that who see things that way. And part of what you try to do with sharing stories is that you try to bring them into that area where things are more complicated and harder to pin down.
For sure.
Going back to your freshly created method, Cynthia, I always find that if groups start sharing stories, at the end of the story circle, people have shared stories they never intended to share.
Oh, yeah.
So the story sharing process reveals stories or stories in a certain form that would have never been shared without that interaction. So even if those people say in before a session, I don't want to talk about X, probably they talked about X, Y, and Z by the end of the story circle, because somebody else that they fear or don't like or are intrigued by shared a story that prompted that story for them. So,
well, I think that's true in that middle area. I think that when you're all the way over on the right, I think that not very many of us have had any experiences in that area. So, you know, I mean, times I've tried to do things in that area, it became immediately apparent that it was not going to work. And we had to, like, you know, hurry up and move people apart because the whole thing was just breaking down.
Well, I mean,
that might be where the systemic modeling might come in handy. For some of the clean language work might be useful over there, where you might actually need a real-time dialogue around a mental model. Anyway, that's a bit of another point around in terms of, but one thing I was thinking is just with what was being said here, I noticed that essentially from what I'm understanding, if we want to look at uncertainty and complexity, we are bringing people together into what you could say is a more ambiguous environment. So it stops them trying to narrow down with preconceived ideas because the ambiguity stops them thinking they know. Or it releases them from the sense that they know, because there's not enough anchors to make them sort of have that certainty of opinion. But there is a decision you might make as to what level of ambiguity do I bring people in on? Because in pretty much all contexts, and I think also with my work, generally speaking, you bring people out of ambiguity. Maybe you bring them, you may increase the ambiguity as you enter them into states of engagement, but once you start to elicit or elicit stories, you choose the level of ambiguity you're going to start at. Be it an improv activity, or in my case, maybe using fabric to start mapping or do non-verbal stuff, and then you might start to sort of look at, okay, where's the key place you'd like to explore, and what story would you like to choose at that place to represent, and from that story, what does that mean? And if you knew that, what story would you tell to someone else? So that does seem to be what this is useful, because I'm processing, because I was talking earlier, I'm really behind on my some of my PhD work, but the thing that I'm kind of interested in is in terms of connecting artifact and journey and how that's useful. Like, I wonder if it's ever possible to sort of ask people, okay, you went on this journey, and it could be a P&I journey, in which case it's much stories, but meaning is important in the stories. But in some ways, I can see other things, it could be objects and it could be experiences of taking meaning together. If they then got to a point where they say, and this is these are the stories that they need them to hear, or we need them to tell us. If there would be a way of saying how useful these different artifacts were to them in coming to that decision, like how much is it useful to have gone through that? Could they say, and I'm pretty much clearer about that because of the insight I got from that improv activity, or from the map that gave me stories, or maybe from the very specific catalysis report, or the even more specific sense-making session. No, that makes sense. That's the question is coming up for me. Is there a sense of how much ambiguity is needed, and how you, in some ways, I sense that you kind of as a facilitator choose that, but you maybe need them to help you to negotiate that because you don't quite know where the sweet spot is.
I'm not sure it's ever possible to know. At least not prospectively.
I was going to say retrospectively, maybe.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think one thing that's important is that you can kind of, you know, we're talking about kind of nudging people into this space or that space. I think that you need to be transparent about what you're trying to do and why, but you also have to keep like kind of ritual barriers to cross, right? So that's partly what people do when they say, okay, now we're going to stop doing this and we're going to do this other thing. And here's why we're going to do it. And this is what's next in our process. And then people kind of say, okay, we've closed that door and opened this one. Whereas if you're just walking along next to people and you kind of just keep pushing on them, right? Eventually they're going to say, stop pushing, stop poking at me, you know? Whereas if you say, okay, here's this thing I'd like you to try, and here's this little wall you're going to step over. Would you like to step over that wall? Then they say, okay, let's go and do that thing. I don't know if I'm getting that across.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, because like people don't respond well to being...
social drama topography, they have to go from exploring the theme just with their bodies to now being ready enough to understand the theme that they could place it on a map. So you don't tell them all the other stuff, but you do say that we're going to try and understand the theme enough, and this is the theme, say peer influence, and then tomorrow we want you to then worry about how that fits in to the place. And then once you've done that, now we want you to work out stuff to do with role.
Right, whereas if you just sort of try to guide the conversation without creating this transition, it would just feel like manipulation.
Mm. Well, if you've got lots of people as well, there's just too many arrows going in different directions, isn't there? So you need to, put a little bit of a, because you don't, if you're doing it with one person, it's probably fine.
Right, right.
Because, you know, you're guiding them, but there's too many variables within the group.
Well, that's where a lot of these facilitated processes come from. Is there a way to get a whole bunch of people aligned doing one thing as opposed to just running off in all directions?
That makes sense. So would you agree with the basic premise I was mentioning there about the ambiguity generally becoming set at the beginning at some level and then becoming less? As you approach,
well, it's almost like it has to be more and then less. It almost has to kind of go back and forth depending on where people are at the time, because sometimes people will come in a state of higher ambiguity and you have to help them bring it down, but sometimes they have too little ambiguity and you have to help them pump it up. So, you know, it kind of depends on where they are when you start.
So you can play with, that's true. And there may be this idea of social ambiguity around relationships in the group, and then ambiguity in terms of the sense-making artifact. And there's a balance between them, you know. You bring groups together and suddenly we don't quite know how we all fit together, but you may have a fairly clear set of questions on story, or vice versa. You may really know the group, but it's very, initially, very, very ambiguous in terms of the scope of the question.
Well, consider, like, if you had a little machine, you know, like a tricorder, and it could just go beep, 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 and it could tell you where people are right now, you know? it could go lawful, you know, neutral or lawful chaotic or whatever. And, or it could say neutral something, and it could just give you an indication of where they are. Then you could be like, okay, that tells me where we need to go next. And you can, you don't have a thing like that, except that you can observe people and the way they're talking to each other and their body language and what they're talking about. And you can also know about them before you go in so that you can sort of plan for what you know. Oh, I see. Okay. Bruce said, sorry to say I must go now. Wonderful exchange and thank you all. I am at Grounds for Sculpture to sing along with famous sculptor and founder J. Stewart Johnson Jr. Well, that sounds really cool. Grounds for Sculpture. Everybody should look that up. Okay. Yeah. Well, we should probably all. It's almost 2 hours. Yeah. So, any parting thoughts for anybody?
There's one subject we didn't talk about. What is the facilitator gets fearful?
What if the
facilitator gets fearful? You remember that one? That one time that I was in this mental prison in the UK, and we were there with 8 offenders and something like 8 people from the university that had met over months. And there was a guy that dissected his mother. There was a guy that murders his girlfriend. There was, and I had to lead the session. So the most of the fear was on the facilitator, not on the participants. So what happens to the quality of the system if the participants like each other and there's no fear and the facilitator fears the participant? That's one we never blogged about.
The facilitator, really.
No. Anyway, I was just joking.
No, but the thing is, part of the reason that we have these structured, these facilitated processes is to help the facilitator.
Yeah, exactly. So it's an inexperienced facilitator stick to the method because they fear making mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or vice versa. Sometimes they go off script because they so it can go better both ways. You know what I mean? Like it's being able to know what is possible to tweak when.
Right, and the more experienced people are, the more confidence they have, the more they can go off the script.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I know when I've had situations where I felt in over my head, it was like, go back to the plan, you know?
Yeah.
And don't worry about if it's not fitting the plan perfectly. Just it's better to stick to the plan than to just have everything fall to pieces.
What you tend to find though with artists is they're the opposite, because they're like, hey, we're all doing good things. It's like, and there can be nothing but good that I do because I'm an artist and I'm a good person. So next thing you know, there's like a bull in a china shop, you know?
Yeah.
And then it's like, I'm just learning, I'm just doing mistakes, it's all part of my journey. It's like, well, yeah, but what about the other poor sods who are like, goodness, you know? So but you're right. I think generally it's true, but what I think this conversation is useful for, and actually this is what I'm wondering if this would be useful, is just this idea of ambiguity and how to calibrate. And I think it could be by the facilitator or by the participant, how to calibrate ambiguity in the elicitation. And it could be broader than the story itself. It could be that, because I'm looking at the story being elicited within the context of maybe other sense-making artifacts. Or it could be like when you had that improv activity. You know, you're not recording everything in the improv activity. You're just recording the stories that come out or the opinion. So it could be because there's a trade-off there with the facilitator. You know, like if the facilitator's also inexperienced, maybe the clarity of their instructions isn't as good as it would be when they're... So you've got this... You've got ambiguity by design and ambiguity by incompetence, I suppose.
Well, one thing I've noticed is that when the facilitators are inexperienced, they can't fix it if it's broken. Mm. They can just keep going on with the plan. But there's nothing you can do about that. You can learn later on, you know. But in the heat of the moment, all you can do is stick with the plan.
Yeah, that's true. And even the context can be a difference. Like when you're in the prison, the things you're not used to be in the prison, you know? So you're thinking, don't talk about the soap dropping or anything like that. Like you know, so you don't know what the rules of the game are. You know, how safe are you? How safe aren't you? Because you probably haven't been in that space before. So there's the process and then there's the context. And that can also be, you know, if you have a very experienced PNI person not used to this context, you could have someone else who's maybe used to the context and not used to the PNI. They may actually do better because the key thing in this context is actually... You could probably know is actually being able to read the room, and I'm actually one of the reasons, Cynthia, without chipping in too much, is I'm actually interested in building that as part of my PhD, is to research in these processes coming together and negotiation of the meaning of an artifact. In my case, the artifact actually hasn't even been written down, it's just a piece of fabric, it's just nothing. Someone puts it there as an energy, agreed to be a lake. Now we negotiate, is it a lake? Now it's a lake. So, and then from that point on, it's not going to be a mountain. Yeah.
Every artifact is symbolic. I mean, if the fabric is a lake, it's the same as, you know, a bunch of marks on a couple of words and everything are the representation of our understanding of something. So, I mean, it's like, whether there's words or objects, there's still a lot of symbolism involved.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I think story is less, potentially less representational because it's still a little bit fuzzy compared to, say, an opinion.
Well, the thing about stories is there's a wide range. They can be extremely concrete, practical, and connected closely to opinion, and then they can go all the way over, excuse me, and be very metaphorical. You know, like if you ask somebody a question, they can give you a very straight answer with a story, or they can give you an extremely oblique answer with a story. Mm. That's what's one of the strengths of it, is that it goes across that range.
Mm. And it's not easy to necessarily unpack that. I mean, the thing is, would this sound a useful piece of research to have feeding in, like the way that things are related to in terms of the journey or a specific interaction with meaning making for the outcome?
I think I'm a very concrete person.
Yeah.
I need concrete examples to sort of make sense of.
Okay, yeah.
You know what? Maybe we can have a different discussion about that.
So you had the pink and blue fabric and you were looking at how the use of that to frame the meaning making of a story or a particular story, how ambiguous or not ambiguous it was, could be reflected on later in terms of how did that seem to help someone in terms of coming up with their insight further down the line.
Right, yeah. Well, it depends a lot on the individual. I mean, people vary so much
in
the way they think. So some people, it's kind of like that thing I said about Dungeons and Dragons. Some people really need things to be simple, and others are much more comfortable and even prefer ambiguity. So the same thing that help one person will actually hinder another person.
So you need to almost look at their role, a bit like Harold was saying before. Like if you know, okay, how would an accountant look at it, or how would an artist look at it, or then maybe that would be more, you'd have something a bit more structured. Otherwise it's just like, could be anything, it's too random.
Well, there are accountants who are artistic and they're artists who are numerical. I mean, it's more like, people vary on a lot of different things, but you almost have to discover it as you do it, really. I'm not sure that you can categorize people in that way beforehand. Anyway, I think...
Okay, yeah, thanks.
I'm going to stop the recording now.